From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, a new documentary series gives voice to the young women who say they were victimized by musician R. Kelly and looks at the people who protected him. Then Spike Lee talks about the challenge of mixing humor with some very serious subject matter in his film, Black Klansman.
It's very hard to get the right balance. It's like a tightrope walker. You go off balance to the left or right. You know, when you hit the ground, you're going to be splattered.
And the venerable Count Basie Orchestra swings its way to a Grammy nomination. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, nominated for a leading 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Original Screenplay, Cinematography, Acting Ensemble, Director, and Best Picture of the Year. Awards eligible in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. R&B singer R. Kelly is in the news once again for his alleged sexual abuse of underage girls. Some of the purported victims of the singer, whose real name is Robert Sylvester Kelly, appear in a new documentary series called Surviving R. Kelly.
My mom would call the studio. The runners would actually let Robert know that I had a phone call, and then he would let them know to transfer the call to me. I do know that there were times where when she would get through and she'd be upset and saying she couldn't contact me and things like that. So it very well could have been times where she was calling and they weren't allowed to put me through.
In 1994, R. Kelly married the 15-year-old singer Aaliyah, and for more than 20 years, he's been accused but never convicted of assaulting underage women. LA Times TV critic Lorena Lee recently reviewed Surviving R. Kelly. She's also a longtime music journalist, and she began with R. Kelly's pattern of alleged abuse.
Allegedly, he was trolling malls and high schools for underage girls. And he had a posse around him, whether it was his, you know, personal handler, people on his tour, that would go and help him get these girls, you know, drop off the number. R. Kelly really wants to talk to you. And of course, these girls are 13, 14, enamored with this guy. So, you know, in the documentary, you have woman after woman now coming forward about R. Kelly pulling them in when they were very young, controlling them, in some instances, allegedly keeping them locked up in hotel rooms for months at a time. And as this is going on, his career is skyrocketing and he is becoming a massive superstar. So therefore, he has this kind of universe around him of yes people, of people who will do anything for him. And then out beyond that, you have a whole pop world that's like worshiping this guy, right? So who's going to tell him no? They're all helping him find these girls. And in retrospect, and in this documentary, they talk about, like, well, I knew it was wrong, but, you know, I kind of turned the other way, or I thought something was going on, but I wasn't sure. And it's like, come on. But I think, you know, it's a larger problem in the music world. We talk about it in film. We talk about it in TV. These stories are coming out. But I think in music, it's been a much more accepted thing in terms of young girls hooking up with these older stars. And it's kind of like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's all part of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
The other thing that is notable is that the documentary filmmakers tried to reach out and talk to a number of very prominent artists about working with R. Kelly, why they did so, what they think about him now. One person, John Legend, goes on camera. A lot of people won't go on camera at all. So what does that have to say about the moral compass of his musical collaborators?
I wasn't really surprised, actually, that John Legend, you know, was the only one to come forward, because there has been this ongoing sort of code of silence, not just for R. Kelly, but for many stars in the music world. And, you know, R. Kelly is also not just a singer, right? R. Kelly is a producer. He's a songwriter. You know, he has his talents go into many things. And as early as, what, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, Lady Gaga was working with him. Jay-Z's done two albums with him. And this is after numerous reports of and women coming forward, you know, with allegations against him. So it wasn't as if, like, well, there was really no proof. It's like there was a videotape and you're still doing this.
The other thing that I think is really interesting is that what also happened is that R. Kelly's alleged behavior became fodder for comedians. And in some ways, that made the story almost not real. I want to play something from Dave Chappelle from a skit he did in 2003. So this is how prevalent the stories are more than 15 years ago. So that's a reference to the videotape and about urinating on a woman. And it's getting a lot of laughs, but it feels like turning R. Kelly into a punchline in some ways enables the behavior to continue.
Right. I mean, it's somehow, you know, we can laugh at it because it's a crazy overblown world where weird things happen. You know, and R. Kelly kind of remade himself at one point from this like super nasty, you know, sexed up R&B guy into a spiritual singer, right? With I Believe I Can Fly. So the idea that these tapes came out, comedians loved it because it's like, oh my gosh, we can knock this guy off the pedestal. And it's really funny. But then where was the accountability for those young girls? And that was the piece that was missing.
The series has been incredibly popular on Lifetime. Almost 2 million people watched it in the first week, and that has translated to more attention for his music, and Spotify is reporting that R. Kelly's music has increased 16%. But he also still has a record label. What does this have to say about popularity and what that grants you in terms of what you can get away with?
The interesting thing about R. Kelly, which isn't the case with a lot of artists, is that as these stories were starting to come out in the early 2000s, the more disturbing they were, the more his music sold. And it wasn't as if he was a huge star when this stuff started coming out. His career seemed to bump up a notch every time something really horrible about him would come out.
And I don't want to look at television for leadership on this issue, but Roseanne Barr puts out a racist tweet and ABC drops her show, which is the number one show on television. R. Kelly, even if he were dropped by his record label, somebody else would sign him, right? Because he sells records.
Yes.
There seems to be a different way of judging somebody's behavior. And I wouldn't say television is a shining example, but compared to television, the music business seems like they could learn a little bit.
In this, you know, sort of Me Too era, when we've been looking at all these different industries, music has largely been overlooked. And this is really kind of one of the first things I would say that's come out where people have gone, wow, what is going on in this strange little, you know, ecosystem where this is okay? But also, you know, the music industry and the digital era, it has not done very well. So to lose a artist like R. Kelly, who is a catalog artist, who has so much music that they can still make a ton of money on, and there aren't many of those kind of artists around, and they're not going to let that go easily.
Lorraine Ali is the TV critic for the LA Times. Lorraine, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you, too.
Coming up, Spike Lee shares why he put footage from Charlottesville at the end of his film, Black Klansman.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The movie Black Klansman, directed and co-written by Spike Lee, has gotten some very important attention this week. It just received a Writers Guild of America nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay. And today, for the first time for the veteran filmmaker, Lee was nominated for the Directors Guild of America's Top Feature Film Award. Historically, the WGA and the DGA picks often mirror the Academy Award nominees. Black Klansman is adapted from the memoir of Ron Stallworth. In the late 1970s, as an undercover police officer in Colorado, he posed on the telephone as a racist white man who wanted to join the Ku Klux Klan. His police partner, played by Adam Driver, impersonated Stallworth in person for face-to-face meetings. The film concludes with footage of the white nationalist march in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, and the footage includes the murder of Heather Heyer, who was run down by a car as she was peacefully protesting.
The script was written, and then Jordan Peele called me up and asked if I'd like to do it. And so that's when my co-writer, Kevin Wilmot, and I rewrote the script, and it became very obvious to Kevin and I, all we had to do was connect the past with the present, that the story of Ron Stallworth, that was the 70s. So we just did everything we could, and that's even before the Charlottesville, you know, act of American homegrown terrorism took place. So that's what we knew we had to do. We had to connect the past with the present.
So people who don't know the story of Ron Stallworth and what he was able to do in this small police department in Colorado, how do you hope they see the world differently or appreciate what he did? The audience that doesn't know Ron Stallworth's story before this movie.
Well, to be honest, I really don't answer those takeaway questions. You know, I stopped doing that 2 decades ago. And the reason is that I expect the audience's intelligence too much to tell them what they should think, you know, leaving out of the theater. You know, they tell me, but I really try not to say, the takeaway of this movie is blah, 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 blah.
I want to ask you about Susan Brough. Susan Brough is the mother of Heather Heyer, who was murdered a year before this movie came out.
I think the reason that what happened to Heather has struck a chord is because we know that what she did is achievable. We don't all have to die. We don't all have to sacrifice our lives. They tried to kill my child to shut her up. Well, guess what? You just magnified her.
I want to ask you about Susan Brough and what she meant to this film and what it meant to ask her permission to be able to use her daughter's life as an inspiration for how people can change the world.
That was one of the most hardest phone calls I've had to make in a while. I was not going to disrespect Heather Heyer or her mother by including Heather, you know, without permission from Miss Susan Brough. It's awkward because how can you, you know, you're trying to give condolences for what can you say? You know, her daughter just got murdered in an act of American homegrown terrorism. And so I did that, and then I, you know, asked for permission, her blessing. And I'm still very grateful for Mrs. Brough to give me permission.
Where were you in production when Charlottesville happened?
Charlottesville was August 11th, and we didn't start shooting filming to begin of September.
How did it change the film at all? Obviously, you changed the coda, but how did it change the movie you were making?
When I saw that, I said, this is, when I saw it on CNN, when I saw Agent Orange's perplexing inability to denounce hate.
Good people on both sides.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to go on his grave. And then the surprise was, I didn't know David Duke was there. To my researcher, Judy Ailey, said, guess what, Spike, call me up, says what? We have footage of David Duke speaking. I said, what? I did not know he was there.
At Charlottesville.
In Charlottesville. So you have Topher Grace, who gives a magnificent performance of him, and then we see the real David Duke in the film. I mean, it. To answer your question, sir, Charlottesville, that footage, and is why every time I've seen this film, people sit in that film in silence for minutes, just stunned. That would not have happened without Dakota.
It's easy to look at some of the characters in this film, especially people like David Duke or local Klan members that are being investigated, and say they're numbskulls, they're idiots, they're clowns, whatever they are. And they might be all those things, but that doesn't mean they're not dangerous. I want to ask you about the tone of the film. I want to play you something that John David Washington, who plays Ron Stallworth, said to us about what he thought the tone of the film needed to be and why it was important to get it right.
I didn't look at it as a comedy. It didn't feel like a comedy during my process. You know, Ron took his job very seriously. So did I. And what was happening, you know, with the story, I mean, it's on the audience to kind of find the comedy in it, I guess. But I didn't play into it, neither did Adam, you know. So, and like you said, they were very dangerous people, and they were organized. You know, this is organized hate we're talking about. So I had to be very careful with not making a joke out of it, and I didn't, you know. And it was very serious to me.
He's talking about his co-star, Adam Driver. What were the conversations you had about tone with your department heads, with your actors?
Well, there really wasn't much discussion. Everybody, I think everybody knew what we had to do. And to talk about the tone, let's deal with that first. When Jordan Peele gave me the pitch of the film, the six-word pitch, Black Man Infiltrates KKK, the first word that came to my mind is this true? And then Jordan said yes. And then the next word, this is absurd. So the humor, this is not a comedy. The humor from Black Klansman comes from the absurdity of the premise. So it's organic. Kevin and I weren't writing jokes. We were getting the humor organically from the premise. Now, the word tone. What's hard is what we did. You have to get the right balance. Some of my favorite filmmakers have done this. Stanley Kubrick for Dr. Strangelove. What is more serious than the annihilation of this earth, of humankind? I don't know if you get more serious than that, but that film has a lot of humor in it. So it's been done before. I didn't do the right thing way back in 89. But it's very hard to get the right balance. It's like a tightrope walker. You go off balance to the left or the right, you know, and they're coming to scrape you. You know, when you hit the ground, you're going to be splattered.
When the credits roll after the coda, you choose a rendition of Mary, Don't You Weep by Prince, which I don't think had been released before.
No.
Why did you choose it to end the film with?
My good friend, Troy Carter, is an advisor to the Prince estate. And I knew I needed something soothing after Dakota, which is the Charlottesville footage. So I asked Troy to come to New York. We wanted to screen it for him. And he said, I think I have something. The next week, I met him in L.A., and played me the song. It's Prince singing a Negro spiritual, Mary, Don't You Weep. Him singing, piano, nothing else.
No, Mary, don't you weep.
On my mother's grave, until my last breath, I believe that Prince wanted me to have this song. There's just no other explanation. This cassette, out of 10,000, shows up. Prince at a piano, just singing by himself, a Negro spiritual. And also, let's make the connection. Negro spirituals, this came out of slavery, where my ancestors, on the Sabbath, we're singing in the church or in the field, wherever, and talk about one day, Lord, you know, we won't be in a bondage. And it just fit.
Yeah. He'll be home.
I've seen the Black Klansman all over the world, and it started the world premiere in Cannes. When the movie ends with the photographs of Heather Heyer. People, you cannot hear a pin drop. You cannot hear a church mouse pissing on a ball of cotton. People, you hear people sobbing, but no one's moving. That is the reason why Prince, my brother, gave me that song, Mary, Don't You Weep, for the end credits. That was not an accident. My brother reached out for me and gave it to me. Delivered it.
Spike, great to see you.
Thank you. And it's a pleasure being on your show.
Coming up, the Count Basie Orchestra is still swinging and has a 19th Grammy Award in its sights.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, nominated for a leading 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including lead actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, acting ensemble, original screenplay, editing, production design, costume design, cinematography, director Yorgos Lanthimos, and Best Picture of the Year. Awards eligible in all categories.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Since its establishment way back in 1935, the Count Basie Orchestra has maintained its reputation as one of the most important jazz groups of all time. William Count Basie remained leader of the group until his death in 1984. Scotty Barnhart is the sixth leader of the orchestra since Basie's death, and Barnhart started off as a trumpet player in the band in 1993. He took the position as its director in 2013. The orchestra has a Grammy nomination this year for Best Large Jazz Ensemble Album for All About That Basie. You're hearing a cut from that record right now. Today, we dig into our archives for my 2015 conversation with Barnhart about conducting a band that's been in existence for 80 years and his love for the late band leader.
We don't have auditions. The orchestra has never had auditions, and we still don't. What happens is, when someone is leaving, he recommends somebody for the spot. And you have to come in and be able to play on the first night, because that first concert could be Carnegie Hall, or it could be a recording session. It could be anywhere. So we don't have time to bring guys in and say, well, let's see how it goes for a week or so. So I got the call out of the blue, probably because the guy who recommended me, I think he was told that I was a huge Basie fan, and Basie was almost always my favorite orchestra from the time I was a kid. So I had the right temperament, I understood the music, I had all the albums, and it was just really a matter of playing whatever part I had to play. And never looked back, so that's kind of what happened.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever spoken with Quincy about his time with the Basie Orchestra?
The first time I met him was in 97, and we were talking about how the band sounded. And he was saying, yeah, man, you guys are smoking. This is 1997 when we were conducted by Frank Foster. And he just was telling me that, you know, the things that the band has always been known for, we were still doing. Like the saxophone section solely on a particular arrangement called In a Mellow Tone. He said, yeah, I can still hear how you guys are playing that the right way and doing this the right way, doing that the right way. So I just remembered that. And so it's my job to make sure we keep doing those things that made the orchestra what it is. And a lot of people, I have to point out, when they talk about the Basie Orchestra, or sometimes when I'm even interviewed, they just want to focus on one particular facet of the band, like 1938 to like 1951 or two. And the band is still recording. Basie died in 84, and he was still recording. So there's this huge 80-year span of the orchestra that I have to be responsible for all of it. And I have to remind people sometimes that you got to check out everything, man. Don't discount the 60s. Don't discount the 70s. Not even the 80s or the 90s either. It's so much stuff out there. And when you really, really look at it, and when you hear us play, like if you were going to Vegas with me now and you hear us play tomorrow night, from the first second, you'll know, oh, that's the Count Basie Orchestra. That's a big deal.
What does that mean? Because you're talking about both being a contemporary band mm-hmm. and somebody who respects the tradition mm-hmm. of the band mm-hmm. itself. And what does that mean to you? Is there a certain style of playing? Mm-hmm. Is there an approach to music? Mm-hmm. Is there an orchestration that's important to you? What are those elements?
It's all of those things. Everything you just mentioned is all of those things that happen to make the whole of it. And I was even like this before I became director. I could hear each individual facet of what made up the band, from the tempo to the arrangements, to how the trumpets were playing together, to how the saxophones played together. And I could also put myself outside of it, like in the audience, and hear how that was sounding. And if something is not right, I'll know exactly what we need to do to fix it. And I can tell somebody, well, you know, you need to listen to this recording from 1971. This is what they were doing. You need to listen to what they did in 83. This is what they were doing. So it's actually more difficult now. I have a difficult job, more so than the guys that were before me, because time keeps passing. We keep playing. We keep recording. So we keep adding all of these things to the music. But there are still basic fundamental things that we have to pay attention to that Basie did better than any other band.
When you become the president of the United States, the people in charge hand you a suitcase and it has the nuclear launch code or something like that. When you take over the Basie Orchestra, is there an equivalent? Is there a Bible, the Ten Commandments that you have to follow?
Yes, the entire,
and what's in it?
The entire recorded history of the orchestra, number one. Number two, all of the guys that are still alive that played in the band. If you can have a relationship with those two particular facets of the orchestra. So, you know, I played in the orchestra for 20 years before I became director. So I played with guys and talked with guys and traveled with guys who knew him, who were in the orchestra for 40 and 50 years. And I used to ask him questions about that. And one of the main things that I learned, man, is that Basie was a master psychologist. He never really said a whole lot. He believed he wouldn't have to fire somebody. Somebody else would have to do that. He just had a way of knowing what to do, and the first and foremost, he treated the musicians like men first.
So you're a football coach first, musical director second?
I wouldn't say a football coach. I would say I'm a human being first.
Okay.
And just I treat the guys as human beings first, as men first.
Count Basie died more than 30 years ago, and yet I believe there's still a few members of the orchestra who were hired by Basie himself.
Mm-hmm.
Do they play a special role, to your mind, in keeping the sound of the band alive? Do they have a special part of the chemistry of the band?
Yes, they do. Clarence Banks, for example, is one of our trombonists, and he was the last musician actually hired by Basie. But when we're talking about different musics and different things to play, sometimes when I'm putting a set list together, he'll remember something that they did. Some of that stuff that we play still isn't written down. You know, so every once in a while, we'll have something like that, and he'll say, no, it needs to be this way or it needs to be that way. And in fact, he just gave me a recording a few weeks ago of Basie's last gig, the one at the Palladium here in Los Angeles, like 2 days before he died. And when I listened to it, I could hear where the band, how the band had arrived to a certain amount of weight, to a certain amount of depth even. We're talking April 1984, how that band, how he had figured out how to let each section just progress and get deeper and more in the beat and even more laid back at the same time. And when I heard that, I was like, wow, there are a few things on there that they're doing that we need to make sure we're doing. It's a task that consumes me 24/7. I'm thinking about it all the time. And, you know, 50 years from now, I should be able, whenever my days are up conducting, I should be able to pass this thing along to the next generation and it be in great hands and it be in good shape. You know, like I was given. I was given an orchestra, it was in great shape. So it's easy to mess it up, actually.
That was Scotty Barnhart, music director of the Count Basie Orchestra. The group has a Grammy nomination for Best Large Jazz Ensemble Album for All About That Basie. And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.